get all of our stuff crazy, can't we? Give all the rest of you.
I didn't realize I didn't have my notes until I got halfway over here, so.
This lecture might get off the track, I don't know.
So I remember we were talking about energy.
We just defined work.
And had got to the point where we said that work was equal to a force times a distance, and that energy is equivalent to it. Now, in my notes I had about 10 different ways in which energy is expressed. And I can probably only remember two or three of those ways. Now, if we have a force times a distance, we can express work as force poundles in the English system, for example. Foot poundles. Foot, see, that'd be the distance, and the force could be pounds. Now you see, force is a mass times an acceleration. But if I have the force of gravity pulling something down, then the weight in pounds represents an attraction, because there's an acceleration going on from that mass. It's being attracted by gravity, and acceleration is a constant number. So that's one way people express energy.
Why did they say poundles instead of pounds?
Oh, I don't know. History. Somebody someplace decided to do it. I don't know the history of it. All right, now, you could also express energy in watts. I believe you can. Yeah, I know you can. Watts. Huh?
You gotta have a unit of time.
Well, I gotta have time in it? No, wait a minute. Power is a thing we haven't defined. Power is equal to the rate at which energy is expended, isn't that right? So power is equal to the rate, which means energy per unit time, energy expended in a given time. Power would be watt hours, watt times hours.
Power is watts.
But watts alone is energy.
No, energy is watt hours, and power is watts.
Power is watts.
You pay for the electrical energy you use is measured in watt hours, kilowatt hours.
Power is watts.
No, that's how much power you use.
Mm-hmm. Your meter on your house reads watt hours, doesn't it?
That's energy.
Yeah, okay, an example of power then is watts. And watt hours would be a measure of energy. Now, physicists may use the electron volt, and do very often. Now, this has to do, they'll say there was energy of 1,000,000 electron volts. That would be the energy an electron would have if it were accelerated through 1 centimeter by that kind of a potential, that many volts. Let's see, you can say CC atmospheres is a measure of energy. A pressure in atmospheres times so many cubic centimeters change in volume. Well, there are a whole raft of them. But if you get to analyzing them and get them back to the fundamental things we were talking about the other day, every one of them will have the dimensions of a force And a force, let's see, we had mass times acceleration, which an acceleration is centimeters per second squared, and we have times centimeters. Is that the dimensions? I think that's right. So no matter what units you express them in, and there are many, I shouldn't say units, no matter what expression you use, and these are unique to a certain discipline. An engineer might use BTUs per hour as a measure of energy. But if you analyze them and break them down to the fundamental units, they will all come back to mass, length, and time. Now, there are other phenomena in nature that cannot be expressed, at least we don't know how to express them, in terms of these fundamental things of mass, length, and time. We have such phenomena as electric charge. And you just can't dream of any way a charge could be related to mass, or time, or distance. Now it may be, but in everyday use it isn't. So you have to dream up some new things. And you have to define arbitrarily, just as you've defined arbitrary units of time and length and mass. They're all invented by man. You have to have a value for the electric charge. Now, indirectly, the electric charge of an electron is what is used as a standard. Now, we have magnets, too. And we have the phenomena of magnets, and you can't relate that particular kind of a phenomena to length, mass, and time. And so you have to have what is the equivalent of electric charge, but relating to magnetic forces rather than electrical forces. And these take on all kinds of different units. They get mixed up at MPS units, international units. Through the years, there have been all kinds of arbitrary units. But we set standards on these things, just as we decide a meter is a certain length. And then we use those standards throughout all of science to measure various phenomena. There is another thing that you have to deal with, known as the dielectric constant. The dielectric constant of a vacuum is set as having a value of 1. Again, that's an arbitrary kind of a thing, because nobody knows the absolute value of any such thing. Is there a certain absolute value of length that ought to be the fundamental? Well, nobody knows, so you just arbitrarily choose a certain one. Okay?
Well, so what does this refer to, this dielectric constant?
All right. If I have two charges, If I take out my comb and I rub it on my wool suit and I charge a what's called a pith ball, it's just a sort of like a piece of cork, round in shape and hangs from a string, and I put a charge on that, and I put a charge on the other one, then they will repel each other. You'll see this experiment in elementary physics books. Well, if you know what the charge is, the force, here's the experiment. There's a certain charge on these things. See, like charges repel. So there'll be a certain angle here, there'll be a certain charge on there. And we'll do this in a vacuum, say. Then the force between these two things, as determined by experiment, is equal to the charge here, and I guess I'll use Q for that symbol, Q1 times Q2, they may not necessarily have the same charge on them, divided by the distance apart squared and divided by the dielectric constant. Now that's one of the fundamental things of science. Now you say, well, where does that formula come from? Well, it comes out of men's minds by intuition, deduction, and experiment. They arrive at these things. There's nothing magic about them, their inventions. All a guy says he's discovered a law. You see it all the time in books. So-and-so discovered a law. Well, he didn't discover a law, he invented one. he invented a law to explain a body of accumulated facts integrated in with maybe a new experiment that he did. And the laws keep changing because you have to keep inventing new laws to keep up with an experiment that didn't obey those laws. And so you try and modify it and make it cover more experiments than it used to. So a vacuum has a dielectric constant of 1. You see, if this dielectric constant is a higher number, the force between the two charged things decreases. We can apply it to two electrons in space at a certain distance apart. If the dielectric constants that somehow be decreased or increased, then if the dielectric constant were decreased, there'd be more attraction between them according to that formula. And if it were increased, there'd be less attraction. Now, as far as we know, a dielectric constant can't be less than 1, but it can be more than 1. For example, in water solution, the dielectric constant is about 80. And the reason we think that things like sodium chloride ionize is because of the dielectric constant. Sodium chloride, the solid, the white solid, contains a network, a cubic lattice of sodium ions and chloride ions of opposite charge. And this continues all the way out through the lattice. This would be a two-dimensional cross-section through the structure of sodium chloride. Now, air and empty space between the atoms having a dielectric constant of 1, this thing stays as a solid. But if you drop sodium chloride in water where the dielectric constant is 80, as the water molecules slowly work their way into here, the force between the oppositely charged ions attract each other. They're pulling each other all together throughout the crystal lattice. This number changes from 1 to 80. So the force is decreased by a factor of 80. And that's why crystalline solids whose components are positive and negative ions, salts, dissolve in water. Now, when we say the speed of light is 186,000 miles per second, we mean in a vacuum. In a substance that has a higher dielectric constant, the speed can exceed the speed of light in vacuum. Because the speed of light depends, not according to this law, but to other laws, depends on the dielectric constant of the material through which it's passing.
Okay. Light will slow down.
But does it slow down?
Yeah.
Let's see, you had your hand up back there.
I wonder what the definition of salt was. Is salt just a crystal of negatively and positively charged ions?
That's right. Salts, the things that are most salt-like mean that you combine group 1A elements with group 7A elements. And the most salt-like of all substances is cesium fluoride, the most electronegative element with the most electropositive element.
Don't they call things like maybe calcium chloride wouldn't actually be a salt?
Yeah, you still call it a salt. Any metal with any element to the right of the zonal border could rightly be classified as a salt. Its primary bonding would be the attraction between the positive and the negative particles, although there may also be some covalent bonding, the two electron bonding we talked about way back when. Well, starting with these things, dielectric constant, magnetic charges, quotation marks, electric charges, mass, distance, and time, you build up all of chemistry and all of physics. Those are the fundamental things. Now, you get a lot of invented and derived things from them, just as we invented energy, made it force times distance. Force we'd already invented as being mass times acceleration. Acceleration was a word invented, the rate of change of speed or velocity with time. And then velocity, which is miles per hour and things like that. You build up thousands and thousands of concepts from basic unitary ideas, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about 6 in number. And you relate all measurement to those 6 kind of quantities. Another attempt by science, you see, to unify all of the phenomena and reduce it down to measurement in terms of certain units. So while we may be speaking about the watt hour, that watt hour can be related right smack back to mass, a distance squared divided by a time squared. Now this concept of having units that go with terms has led people in the past to great conclusions, including Einstein's conclusion that energy is equal to mass times the speed of light squared, the conversion of mass into energy. We call this units analysis, or more, there's a more common term, dimensional analysis. When you break your terms down into these 6 things we've been talking about, you call that dimensional analysis. And if you have something that is energy, then it better have the dimensions that we have over there. Well, let's see if it has. We have mass, and we have centimeters per second squared. So that's squared and that's squared. Einstein arrived at this by the novel thought that mass might be converted into energy somehow, and then simply added to it what was already known to scientists, that this is going to have the dimensions of energy. It plain better well have these units, mass, centimeter squared, divided by second squared. So in hindsight, you see Einstein really didn't do anything very great. But it's always that way. It really was great, but it's simple in hindsight. You see, very simple. Why didn't I come up with that? Good heavens, anybody can come up with that. It's so simple. But the bottleneck or the barrier to coming up with insights like that is really rather great. The same thing with de Broglie. De Broglie came up with a relationship between, let's see, he related I've forgotten the equation. Anybody remember de Broglie's equation? He related mass and wavelength and other things to each other, and he did it by dimensional analysis. No great deal today. Any kid who's a senior in science could have done the same thing. But it's all in hindsight. But scientists still use the scheme whenever you're projecting and inventing out into the unknown with some kind of reasoning. You always go back to dimensional analysis for your formula. Now, most all of them have been explored. With 6 basic concepts, you can explore darn near all of the rest of the ideas, and they've all been explored. It's pretty hard to discover anything new. What somebody needs to do in science to do something great is break out into some completely new conception that is away from all of what is in the mainstream of science. Now, maybe something like that doesn't exist, but that's the way that you get some real progress in science. Any question on that kind of thing? Now I want to talk about energy. In energy is very important in our day and age. And I'd like you to get some of the basic concepts in your mind concerning energy. While energy can always be broken down into these dimensional quantities that I've talked about, you can also break energy down into some other kinds of ideas. And energy can invariably be expressed as the product of two quantities, one of them an intensive quantity, and the other one a capacity quantity. Now, sometimes power and energy are, a definition is not made between the two because one is per instant of time and the other is over a period of time. And when a physicist uses the electron volt, for example, as a measure of energy, he's really leaving out part of the story. And there are other units that we use, that we call, and you'll see the charts and handbooks, tables of energy, and they may be power and they may be energy. So I will use the same liberties in this instance here. Now let's go to some simple kinds of energy where we can pick out what is intensive and what is capacity. Now when I do high pressure work, I think of applying a force over a given area. And that's what pressure is. Pressure is defined as a certain force over a given area. When I say in my tire I have a pressure of 30 pounds per inch squared, this is a certain way of measuring the force. Now it's not an absolute thing because I've got this 30 pounds business, I've got to get the acceleration due to gravity into that expression. But we normally leave it out because that's a constant. We could also express it in other ways. Pressure is sometimes said to be an atmosphere. And we know that an atmosphere is the pressure of the air on things at sea level, which is approximately 14.7 pounds per inch squared. We also define a unit, and I use wavy lines, which means approximate, not exactly, the 1 kilovolt, which when divided by 1,000 is also about an atmosphere.
So why don't we say bar?
They do, but in our work we're always dealing with kilobars because bars are too little. Okay, then the National Bureau of Standards has come out recently. It's trying to force everybody to change to newtons per square meter. I'll write that out. And then there is in the older literature, and this is just about an atmosphere also, but not quite. And in the older literature, there's a thing called ponds that the French used to use. And there are still some other ones. Bridgman, all throughout his work, used as a unit of pressure the kilogram per centimeter squared. Well, all of these units represent a force applied to a given area, and all of them, when broken down by dimensional analysis, will come right back to the same thing of a force, which is a mass times an acceleration over centimeters squared.
Don't they use pond nowadays to indicate the weight of a kilogram under a standard gravity?
I don't know. They may do. I haven't seen the term except in real old French literature, in looking through high pressure stuff relating to the kind of work I do. Well, what's going to be the intensity factor, the pressure or the volume?
Pressure.
The pressure is. And the capacity factor is going to be the volume of the system. Now, we usually refer to a difference in volume, we'll put a delta out here. there's a change between some initial volume and some final volume when you apply the pressure. Now let's look at energy that we get due to temperature. Well, the intensity factor is the temperature, and the capacity factor is the heat capacity, given by C. And the product of those two gets you into the energy, perhaps leaving the time out, but still related to the energy. If we look at kinetic energy, man has learned that kinetic energy, which is the energy that a moving object has in it, like a thrown baseball, kinetic energy is equal to 1/2 the mass times the velocity squared. Well, now it gets a little bit difficult in that situation to decide which one might be the intensity factor. Physicists invent another term they call momentum. P is equal to mass times the velocity. So we could rewrite this as 1/2 of P times the velocity. And then one would wonder if velocity were the capacity thing or if this were the capacity thing. It's hard to tell in this one. But for my way of thinking, I would write the intensity factor in kinetic energy as being the velocity, being a more important term. Particular if you're dealing with things on a small scale like molecules and atoms. I would put down here that the velocity squared and the mass over 2 is the capacity factor. Now I had a long list of these things in my notes. Let's see if I can think of some others. Oh, an interesting one is radiant energy. The capacity factor is a constant for all radiant energy, whether it be radio waves, ultraviolet light, visible light, or whatnot. Planck's constant, H. And the intensity factor is the frequency, mu. The higher the frequency, Now I need to tell you that it's the intensity factor that causes change. Much of man's experimentation in science relates some kind of energy to some kind of matter. And the way you investigate the properties of matter is to bombard it or have it interact with some kind of energy. In science, you have a difficult time. It's like the blind man who go out to tell what the elephant is like. And you've heard the story. One blind man gets a hold of the, what does he get a hold of? The ear. And so he describes the elephant as being such and such. Somebody gets a hold of the trunk and he says the elephant is such and such. And somebody got a hold of a leg or something like that and described the elephant as being like a tree. Well, that's what science is. It's pretty blind, but it tries to find out what matter is and what it's like by interacting energy somehow with the matter and seeing how the matter responds. Now, in particle physics, where men accelerate electrons and protons around in these bevatrons and cyclotrons and accelerate them in straight lines at the Stanford Linear Accelerator, to put the things crudely, this is about the kind of an experiment you do. It's like taking rocks and throwing them at a barn, and you're blindfolded, and from the sound, you try and find out what the shape of the barn is. See, if you throw out enough rocks, it'll miss the barn on that side, and maybe one will bounce a little different off the roof than it does on the straight side, and you try to piece together what the shape of the barn is. Well, it's sort of that way in science. It's just that hard a problem. You can't see things with your eyes directly nor feel it with your touch. And so you have these very indirect ways of doing things. Now, the result you get, the reaction you get back from the matter, depends more on the intensity factor than it does on the capacity factor. For years, chemists and metallurgists and ceramicists and physicists have learned about the properties of matter by heating things. This is particularly true of chemists. Chemists put energy into matter. It might be a beaker of acetone, or it might be some solid sodium carbonate. You heat it up, and then with various scientific instruments, you try to find out what happened to it. Well, you add temperature, you add heat energy to the thing. Now, if you want to explore things over as wide a range as possible, then you go to the lowest temperature possible, and you go to the highest temperature possible. And you see what happens to the matter under these extremes of pressure and temperature. If you want to do it by studying it with pressure, then you do the same. You'd study things from the lowest possible pressure to a very high pressure and see how the matter responds. If you wanted to do it with electrical energy, you'd put in a voltage, which would be the intensity factor, and there'd be a certain current that would flow. And the product of those is watts, and if you get time involved with it, then you have energy. Now, in general, there are some exceptions, but in general, you don't learn anything about the matter simply by changing the current, but you do by changing the voltage. You get a lot different effect when you put 1 volt on matter compared to when you put 1,000,000 volts on matter. So the thing that gets the action in science is to take the intensity factor of whatever kind of energy you are introducing to interact with the matter, and then you see what happens. If you take temperature and take water and change it from minus 1 degree centigrade up to 101 degrees centigrade, you will inject into that system something like 25,000 calories of energy, heat energy. Now that's easy to change in temperature by that much. You can do that with a match. Any piece of lighted wood can change the temperature from you go out in the wintertime when it's this kind of temperature and you light a match. The temperature of the hot part of the match can be up near 1,000 degrees centigrade. Now, a match comes cheap or a Bunsen burner comes cheap. So a chemist, you see, has been able to influence matter and observe matter go from a liquid to a gas to different kinds of crystalline solids and observe the heat effects. And then look into that and develop theories regarding the nature of liquid, solids, and gases. If you want to apply pressure to inject this same kind of energy, you have to apply a tremendous pressure. And that was the bottleneck in trying to make diamonds. The intensity factor had to be so high. See, the volume change is limited by the nature of matter. The delta V of squeezing graphite, very small. So to get a lot of energy into the system, you have to have a tremendous pressure. And it took a pressure of around 100,000 atmospheres. And a machine that cost you $35,000 to put 500 calories of energy into the system. And a guy can put that much energy into a mole of a system via temperature by a Bunsen burner that may cost him $1. Okay?
Well, you've been separating these things like they're mutually exclusive, and if you put the pressure on it, there will be some delta V, and if you force it to make some delta V, well, then that means you have to put on a pressure. Like volts and amps, you increase the voltage, you increase the current, too.
It's true. Do you disagree with my saying that one of them is intensive and the other capacity?
No, not really. But
that I'm leaving some things out to keep it simple. Is that all right? It's true, when I put pressure on something, I change its volume. But I may not change the volume very much if I'm dealing with solids, which forces me to change my intensity factor by some tremendous quantity to get an effect. The same thing is true of taking a voltage and placing it across something. You're not going to get an effect unless the voltage is powerful enough to drive the electrons across. And it's true that the current and that these things are related to each other. Are you in electrical engineering? In electrical engineering, you'd say that you'd invent another term, and you'd say that the resistance of something is equal to E over R. And that shows a relationship between these two things, which may not be that simple, but which can be that simple. Likewise, there will be a relationship known as the equation of state between the pressure and the change in volume. But still, that does not keep me from identifying pressure as being a separate entity from volume. I know it's related to volume, but it is a separate entity from volume. See, pressure is related to volume in the simplest way by that equation, which is called perfect, but it's rarely perfect. Heat capacity also is related to temperature, and volts is also related to current. But I choose to set one of them apart as being intensity, the thing that causes the action, really. But they are related to each other. All right, now, the struggle in science has been to increase the value of the intensity factor. Progress in science has come from learning how to increase the intensity factor. Now, that's hard to do. Let's go to electricity. That means you want a higher voltage. Man did not start to learn about electrons, about protons, or the details of atoms and molecules until they learn how to get high voltages. You deal with electrical energy, and you try to get a high voltage. They first did this in things that were called Van de Graaff generators. Well, I guess Franklin did it earlier by trying to tap the electricity from lightning. He had a very high voltage there. Now, as you get higher and higher voltages, you can accelerate particles that are charged to higher and higher speeds. And this is how a lot of what has been learned in science has been learned. Throwing these rocks at the barn at higher and higher speeds to penetrate through things in front of the barn that are shielding us from seeing the barn. Now, as you try to get higher and higher voltages, you run into practical problems. You run into the problem of electrical insulation. This is the limiting factor in getting higher and higher voltages, or at least it is a major limiting factor in getting higher and higher voltages. It's a matter of materials. So as man has worked on the problem, he has developed better and better electrical insulators. In theory, one can get a high voltage by taking a transformer and having a few turns on one side of that transformer wrapped around a rod of iron. Let's make this kind of a transformer. And we put, say, one turn, and we put many turns on this side. And we run an alternating current through that thing. You can have a low voltage on this side and a high current. The energy will be the same. The volts on this side times the current will equal the volts on this side times the current. But if you have a different ratio of turns on this side to turns on that side, the volts over here can be, say, 1,000 times what they are over there. Say over here, we have 1 volt and 1,000 amperes. Over here, it may be possible, perhaps, to have 1,000 volts and 1 ampere. If the transformer is 100% efficiency, the product of these two, which is related to energy, is the same. But what happens over here on this side is that the voltage, when it gets up to a million volts, it'll jump across 3 or 4 feet of space. And so you've got to insulate your wires with some kind of an insulation that will withstand that. You have to physically separate them, which makes the efficiency of the transformer decrease because you can't keep the windings close together and things like that. So you run into material problems whenever you try to increase the intensity factor of any kind of energy you're dealing with. Now, another kind of pressure. In the case of pressure energy, I can use a hydraulic lever. It's like a teeter-totter or a crowbar. I'll have a long lever like this. This is the mechanical description of the hydraulic thing. I can have a very huge weight here that can be lifted by a very tiny weight on the end of the long lever. Our lever doesn't have any weight. It's that theoretical lever they're always using in physics. Well, why can't I carry that to the ultimate extreme for generating pressure? Well, it becomes a materials problem. What I want to do is to get a very tiny thing, like a lady's high-heeled shoe, and then I want to put a very large weight on that. And the force per unit area here, you see, will be very high. Reminds me, you remember when the fashion was those very tiny heels? When the ladies would walk in the airplanes of the day, they'd go through the floor with those. They had to take all the airplanes of that period. I forget when it was. Sometime shortly before or after 1960, and replace all the floors, because the high heel had such a small area that if a lady stepped down just on her heel alone, it would go through the aluminum floor. The pressure was so high.
Well, I should
have
just asked her to take
the
shoes off,
stick right on the internal. Well, the problem you run into here is the strength of this material here. And you could get an infinitely high pressure if materials were just stronger. So you use the highest strength materials you can have, and then you use geometry. In the electrical instance, you use geometry to advantage, and you use electrical insulation to advantage. It's always a materials problem and a geometric problem to increase the value of an intensity factor. If you take the same amount of energy and increase this and have a small value of that, or increase this and have a small value of that. You can do that in a transformer, or you can do it in a lever, or you can do it in a ram, hydraulic ram. But you cannot do it in the case of temperature because the second law forbids it. The electrical transformer is the prototype of the kind of a gadget you use. You take a certain amount of energy. And with the transformer, you disproportionate the relationship between the capacity factor and the intensity factor. That's what an electrical transformer does. That's what we do in the high pressure business. We can do it with other kinds of energy. But when you try to do it with temperature, the second law forbids that. If you could do it, see, you could take any substance that has heat capacity. All substances have heat capacity. I don't know what the gadget would look like, but the analogy of it would be an electrical transformer. You would decrease the heat capacity of the system, and in so doing, you would increase the temperature of the system. And if any of you ever are smart enough to invent a gadget that can do that, you would be the most famous scientist of all time because you would have violated the so-called second law of thermodynamics. Why don't you work on that, Brother Smith?
Colin. I'd feel too sorry for him having to reprint all the textbooks. They just renamed the textbooks classical.
Well, that's what would happen. They'd start calling it classical thermodynamics. Okay, that's just a little lecture that is probably not too exciting, but it really is rather important if you've caught the significance of it. We're talking about energy. We're talking about an intensive component of energy and an extensive or sometimes in various writings on the subject, they call it the capacity component of the energy. Now there's another factor involved that I'll take up on the next time we meet on Friday that has to deal with the effective utilization